This is Anchorman's AI Journey. Tune in to get inspired by the opportunities, impact and capabilities of data, machine learning and artificial intelligence.
Today we sit down with Rens van der Schoot, professor of statistics at Utrecht University with a chair on statistics with small data sets. He was a member of the Young Academy of the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Scientists, and he has been making fame with a new tool to support systematic reviews of literature using machine learning called AS Review, that he developed together with some brilliant colleagues. Also here with me is Raoul Goels, senior data scientist at Anchorman, my co-host for today.
Hi there.
Welcome, Raoul. My name is Ron Dodge, and this is the AI Journey. Welcome, Rens. Or Rens.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Ron.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great.
Yeah? Yeah. Well, can you tell me more about AS Review? What does it do? How does it work?
Yeah, so about 4 years ago, I was working on a paper. I wanted to provide an overview of the use of Bayesian statistics in the field of psychology. And by doing that, you have to read all the papers on that topic. So I did a search, and then I found about 10,000 papers. And then the goal of systematic reviewing is to go through all those papers to find out which of those are relevant. So I was doing this, and on Friday afternoon, I was so sick of reading so many abstracts. And then one of my colleagues walked by my office, Daniel Obersky, and then I asked him, can't we develop a tool that can actually do this for me? I'm so sick of it. So, and that was actually the start of this journey, AS Review. It started out as a little pet project with the two of us. And then now, a couple of years later, it's one of the biggest open source projects of the university. And our tool is downloaded, I don't know, maybe 200,000 times, used by many different institutes. And how it works is you start with this pool of data, like the 10,000 articles I started out with. And then in the end, and that's why it's called small data, in the end, you only describe 30 of those papers in your final paper. So how to find the needle in the haystack. That's actually the goal of AS Review.
So that's awesome because it saves a lot of time.
It saves an enormous amount of time, yeah. So we did a lot of simulation studies. You can easily save 50 to 90% of your time in this abstract reading phase.
So how does it work? Is it just, I give it some keywords and it gives me all the papers that I need to read? Or how does that work?
No, that doesn't start with keywords. So the methodology behind the scenes is active learning, where the machine interacts with the human. So you start out with one relevant paper. You always know one paper, maybe your own paper or of a colleague or a famous paper in your field. So you start with a relevant paper, which you already know, and then a random irrelevant paper. And based on that information, the rest of the papers is actually ordered from most to least relevant.
But and the rest of the papers, that's some subset you already have of? Or does it just search archive?
No. So it has to be a limited set of papers in the pool.
So you first make sure you have a set of 10,000 papers, and that's your...
Yeah. So you have to start out with a pool of papers that are relevant. So that's actually the search query with the keywords. So that's something you do first, because you cannot search the entire literature. That's almost impossible. Although we have implemented the COR19 database, and the COR19 database consists of all the papers on Corona. So there are currently, I think, 350,000 papers. So that's close to the entire literature on COVID-19. But typically people start out with a smaller data set, let's say 5,000 or 10,000 papers that comes out from a search. So you first search with keywords in databases, then you end up with 5 to 10,000 papers. You start with one relevant and one irrelevant paper as a training set. Then the machine learning model predicts relevant scores for the unlabeled cases. And then you as a human, you're the oracle. And you're presented the most relevant paper, and you have to make the decision whether that new paper is relevant or irrelevant. Yeah, you make the decision.
So the machine tries to find out, like, what do you think? Like, what are your objectives based on what you do? And it tries to learn from example from what you do.
Correct.
And then it only needs, like, and then it presents you the things it's uncertain of, or...
No, yeah, so that's a very good question. So there are actually two ways of doing this. You have certainty-based sampling and uncertainty-based sampling. So in active learning, you can either train the model with uncertainty-based sampling. So then you're shown the paper or whatever the topic is, which is most uncertain to help to improve the performance of the model most. That's what's called uncertainty-based sampling. And then the output is the model itself. And you then want to use the model for making future predictions. But that's not what we do. So we have the certainty-based sampling. And then the goal is to read all the relevant papers in the pool.
Yeah.
So every iteration, the model predicts relevant scores. And it's showing you the article or the paper or the text. Because it can also be a newspaper article or any text. And it shows you the text which is most relevant according to the last iteration of the machine learning model. Then you annotate the paper. You label it relevant or irrelevant. The model is retrained. All the papers are reordered according to the relevant scores again. And you continue labeling papers until you've seen all the relevant papers in the pool.
Let's take one step back. So why do you even need this approach? Why do you need active learning, right? Because regularly what you have is for any purpose, you train a machine learning model based on some input data.
Yeah.
And you have labels, the ground truth, right? And so you predict the ground truth, you predict the labels from the input data. Now here you cannot do this, right? Because the machine doesn't know what you're interested in, right? So this is the reason you need active learning. You need the machine to start understanding, which is also what Raoul said, to start understanding what are the papers that you are interested in. And if you were to label all of the papers in the literature, like the 350,000 COVID papers, you're already not doing the machine learning thing, right? You're already reading all the papers.
Yeah.
So this is the problem that you're solving, right? The challenge that you had, this active learning. So how did you get to this active learning idea?
So first off, yes, you're completely correct. The goal is to read fewer papers than that there are papers in the pool. Because classically, a classical systematic search means that you have to go through all the papers. So the task is a bit different than, for example, with search engines, where the first hit has to be relevant. But the goal of systematic reviewing is to find all the relevant hits. And because of that, you have to read all the papers that you found in the search. But then that's too much, because reading, I don't know, 10,000 papers will take you a year, and you want to publish your paper within a year. Or, for example, take a use case of COVID-19. You have to develop a medical guideline. On Monday morning, you're receiving an email with a request to develop a medical guideline about a new drug, which might be relevant for treating COVID-19. And on Friday, you have to publish your medical guideline. And the classical approach is to do a search, read all the papers, but that's not possible anymore because there are way too many papers.
So then AS Review starts with a couple of papers and it will try to figure out what papers are you interested in by showing you some examples, and then you label just a small set of them. And labeling means I'm interested in this paper, I'm not interested in this paper,
correct.
I'm interested in this paper. Then it retrains, and then it will give you, after a couple of iterations, the papers that you are really interested in.
And no. It retrains the model after every decision.
After every decision.
Yes.
After every single added label. So after every paper. So it retrains the model. And then,
so while you're reading the abstract, on the back end, the model is being retrained.
Okay. That's awesome. And so what then actually is it using in terms of input? Is the machine learning model actually reading the paper?
Yeah, so whatever you provide in the front end. So if you have the title and the abstract, it's basing the relevant scores on the information in the abstract.
All right.
Or in the title.
So it's using there something understanding the grammar of the papers and the actual contents of the papers, or is it more of a topic based thing? Like, how deep is it going?
Yeah, so we have different. So what you're referring to is what we call feature extraction.
Mm-hmm.
So a machine learning model cannot do anything with text. It has to change text into numbers, and then the numbers can be used for the machine learning model. And that's what we call feature extraction. And we have implemented very different approaches. So a very simple feature extraction method, like a TF-IDF, which is very easy, but also word2vec, and we have more complicated ones, the SBIRT feature extraction
techniques. Yeah, I saw BERT there. For those of you who are not knowledgeable with it, this is like a word embedding that's able to convert text words to numbers, but in such a way that the context matters. So the bank as in a river bank versus a bank as a bank that I put money in will give you a different set of numbers because they mean different things.
Correct. Yeah.
And so you've written a paper about this, comparing all these different approaches. And one thing that was interesting to me in the results that I saw there is that it looks like, you know, people always think I have to use the most complicated algorithm to get the best results. But I think that's not what your paper said that was needed.
Yeah, true. We conducted a lot of simulation studies, and actually a very cheap method, naive Bayes, performs very good. And cheap means quick in terms of computational time, because you have to. So the deep learning models and neural network models, the more complicated feature extraction techniques, they take time. It just takes time to run the computations, and because the software runs locally on your machine, it depends a bit on your laptop how quick the computations can be completed. So the thing is that while you're reading the abstract in the backend, a new machine learning model is being trained. And apparently it's the case that retraining the model after each iteration is better in terms of performance than continuing screening the papers from one iteration while you're waiting 2 days for a machine learning model, a deep learning model, to be completed. So retraining the model quickly is better, apparently, than the neural network models.
And how do you know you're done? Like, you get paper, you get one paper, two, and then you have 10 relevant papers, but there might be 10 more, and then you get some, and then maybe the quality of the review starts dropping or something. Or can you say at some point I just get irrelevant papers? Or
So this is a very cool question. So this is the stopping problem.
Yeah,
and for any active learning task, the stopping rule is impossible to compute, because you never know whether there's still something relevant in the pool you've not seen. So it's actually unsolvable.
Yeah. So it's
we can only come up with pragmatic guidelines. So let's say a very simple heuristic is, if you've seen 100 papers in a row that are irrelevant,
then stop. Yeah.
Then you can maybe stop.
Yeah, probably.
But maybe the 150th paper is relevant again.
Yeah, but this is a human problem as well, right? If I were to read everything, you also don't know when to stop.
No, there are some research done, not in my group, but in other groups, that as a human you also typically fail to find 10 to 15% of the papers due to screening fatigue. And that's why you have to screen with two or three researchers to find those papers So stopping is an issue. You can also stop when your time's up. If you have a week time, then you stop after a week.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe my time is more expensive than Ron's time, for example. So Ron can maybe screen a bit longer.
Yeah, I have all the time in the world.
or maybe not.
actually, to tag along a little bit on that question, Raoul, because what is also interesting to me is how do you even measure performance here, right? Because you don't have your ground truth, or do you? How do you measure performance of your active learning approach?
So there are two approaches. So you have the simulation mode, where you have a data set which is already labeled. So then the truth is the labels as provided by a manual search and the manual labeling. So the labels are known. That's easy. But for an unlabeled data set, so a new systematic search, you don't know. There's no performance metric. The only thing you can measure is the number of relevant papers that you already found in the screening process so far.
Have you used it? And is maybe your feeling of, hey, this is working metric to measure the effectiveness of the whole thing?
Yeah, so from a user perspective, what we see is that, so you start with this prior knowledge, a relevant paper and an irrelevant paper. Some people have more relevant papers to start out with because they already did a search or they have more papers. And then the thing is that in the first couple of iterations, you already see the first relevant paper popping up. And then again, another relevant paper. And then in the first 100 iterations, you already have found most of your relevant papers. Well, normally, so people that are used to systematic reviewing, they know that you can screen for days without finding a relevant paper. If you go randomly through the pool of 10,000 papers, well, if you start out on Monday morning, maybe you will find your first relevant paper on Wednesday afternoon. Mm-hmm. So now you already find all the relevant papers early in the screening process. And the longer you're screening, the fewer papers you will find relevant.
Is it possible that you run into like these kind of these biases, like these internet bubbles that people sometimes talk about, echo chambers, because I select only those papers that are in favor of my scientific view or whatever as relevant, that I might miss a lot of alternative views on the topic or something like that? Will it just echo my biases, or is there something you can put in there?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And this has to do with garbage in, garbage out, or quality in, quality out. Mm. So typically you start with a very clear inclusion and exclusion list. So what are you going to include? You have to decide on that before starting your screening process. What is relevant to you? Is there a list of inclusion or exclusion criteria? Are you interested in children? What's the exact age range? If you're interested in COVID-19, what exactly are you interested in? And what are you not interested in? So you have to come up with a clear set of inclusion and exclusion criteria. And you have to adhere to those criteria during the entire screening phase. So you're not allowed to change your criteria. If you do that, you have to start all over again. This has nothing to do with ACE review. This has to do with systematic reviewing. The word systematic means that you have to read and screen every single paper in your data set with exactly the same inclusion and exclusion criteria.
So I'm thinking about how this might translate to other domains, and I think it's clear that it can be used for other domains. Has it been used already?
Yes. Yeah, I know some people using it for newspaper articles. So actually, it does not matter what kind of text you enter into the system. It's just text. As long as you have a column with text and the rows are records, then you can actually upload the database. So we started out with systematic reviewing in scientific literature because to solve my own problem. And many people are working in this area. But actually, any text processing can be done with ACE review. If you only want to find a very small subset of relevant papers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a large pool of text, so that's the use case.
Yeah, what I found interesting about this is that you're more than replacing what a human does; you're more collaborating with a machine.
Yes.
So, and that also fits a bit into what Ron said about bubbles. So yesterday I was watching something from Max Hawkins, and I don't know if you know him. He's a programmer, and he randomized his life. So he was a programmer at Google, and he said, like, oh, how I'm constantly, my behavior is so predictable, so you can predict where I will be tomorrow just looking at my GPS track. And then what he said was like, okay, he built an app that randomized where he went to. So he just built an app that picked a random Facebook event and ordered an Uber and then sent him there. And then what I found interesting about it is that he said, like, I never felt so free when doing this. So when I was thinking about, like, this collaboration with a machine, it always is the question, like, what do you put into it? Like, what's your objective? And maybe, yeah, sometimes randomizing might be more interesting also. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, this is really cool. I like this very much. So what we also have, so ACE review is not a set software package. It's a research software package. So we integrated a lot of little jokes and tricks and thingies. So there's also this option of a mixed query strategy where you can also add randomness.
Oh, nice.
So for example, that 90% is this certainty-based sampling, and 10% of the papers you've seen are just random.
Oh, I liked it.
Yeah. And you can play around with this percentage. And then you can do a lot of funny stuff with it. I mean, based on those random papers, you can do some predictions. At least that's what we thought. But the probability of finding a relevant paper in the pool by adding 10% random papers, that's almost zero. So the chance that you include a paper in the set of the 10% relevant papers you then screen is just almost zero.
Yeah, but I think it really depends on your objective. Like, if your assumption is I have a fixed set of papers that I want to find and that is not changing, then it's just okay to just maximize that. But if you're trying to come up with a new idea, your collaboration with the machine might differ.
Yeah.
Like, and you might want to say, no, I want to spark my creativity. And at that point, it might be very interesting to, I don't know, have the equivalent of being dropped at a random place and just wondering yourself, like, what am I doing here? Or
yeah, so give me a random paper.
Yeah, yeah, but then I think it requires something else, right? So we, like, listening on Spotify to the music that's being advised, that's comfortable, maybe. So, but it requires some different, like, in that way, you ask the algorithm to take the decision for you. So you say, so I don't make the decision, let the machine do it. But yeah, it's different from collaborating.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so that's the difference between, as I explained before, the certainty and uncertainty-based sampling. So uncertainty-based sampling gives you a model. For example, in Spotify, it gives you a model, and then there comes a new song, and it fits into the prediction of your model. And then it's shown to you like, oh, because your model is like this, you might also want to listen to this song. And what you're now saying is that you don't want to pick a song within your comfort zone, but just something completely opposite to it.
Yeah, yeah.
So do surprise me.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can do the same thing with text classification, of course. So you can, and that's, Ron, what you refer to, the topic modeling. The moment you have this model in place of the papers that you find relevant, you can also present the user with the paper completely on the opposite, but probably that's on a topic that this person is not interested in.
Yeah, so then there might be a sweet spot between that, right? So
okay, Barul, here's the challenge for you. So this is an open source project. So the idea of Ace Review is to co-develop the software. Can we expect a pull request from you on our GitHub website with this surprise me button? Like, just, you know, after screening for 8 hours, you can hit the surprise me button and then a complete random paper that's completely orthogonal to everything you included so far pops up. That would be cool, right?
That would be cool, yeah.
It's probably also possible to find a paper that is kind of within the cluster of interesting papers, but like a little bit outside of the neighborhood. That's like a little bit outside of the comfort zone, but still tangibly relevant. Doesn't need to be the most opposite one, right?
No, of course. You can play around with personality characteristics.
Yeah. I mean, but so you mentioned GitHub and open source, and I know this plays a large role in your endeavor for AS Review. Can you tell us a little bit more about how AS Review was built, what technologies it's using, how open source ties into this?
Yeah. So in science, at least in the Netherlands, but also especially in Europe, we really want to change the scientific community. We want to become open science. That's the thing. But then you have to practice what you preach. So when we started out with this project, I had long discussions with our lead engineer, Jonathan de Bruin, from the IT department, what to do with the code. Because in the end, if you develop software, if you want to sell it to a company, or if you want to come up with money or fees or service products, your code has to be closed.
Mm-hmm.
But that's completely opposite to the open science perspective. So then we had this discussion, and he challenged me to put everything online, just everything. So all the source code, everything, all our stupid mistakes are there, all of the brilliant ideas are there. And that was a big challenge. And it also ties into the new rewarding system in academic society, because we normally count the number of papers you published and we compute the H index. And that makes you, if your H index is high and if you publish a lot of papers, then you're famous. But coding and annotating code, that's not actually rewarded so much. But it takes a lot of time. It's crazy how much time it costs to actually annotate the code and come up with good documentation. So we have, I don't know, 150 pages of documentation, and not even everything is in there. But it's not rewarded. I mean, I don't have a publication about the documentation. But it makes a big difference between just some scripts and software that people can use and co-develop by the open science community. So it took a lot of time, but I'm really proud. Everything is now open, and people are contributing to it.
What was precisely the challenge for you there? So you said it's a challenge. Well, what made it challenging?
Yeah, Because all of our mistakes are also openly available.
Oh, yeah, so you were afraid people would see the code and they would point and laugh.
And that's also what they did.
Yeah. All right. So, and was it a pleasant experience?
Well, in the beginning, our project did not get so much attention. So it were mainly people close to us that were laughing a bit, like, haha, what are you doing? Look at line 42. I mean, that's completely insane. But the good thing is that now we are a couple of years later and people are actually contributing to the code. And that can only be done if the code is really clear, well-structured, annotated, and if everything is there. I mean, if part of the code is still hidden, then no one will contribute via this
open
science.
It makes the quality better.
It makes the quality better.
But how do you, like in an academic context, I can imagine, well, it's an obstacle maybe that you say like, oh, they see our mistakes, but well, in a commercial context, you also have like the problem, like it's the way companies earn money, right? Their code is closed, and so do you have a solution for that? So how to convince like a commercial company to open their source code?
Yeah, so this ties into a discussion about ethics. So I strongly believe that if there is a machine, an AI tool, making decisions, I think it's essential that the code is open.
Mm-hmm.
So even if then the profit is less for a company, and I'm working at the university, so I don't care about profit. Yeah. I just want to pay my brilliant researchers and scientists and programmers and engineers. That's my goal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's essential in this time where machines are making more and more decisions for us that we as data engineers can actually check what's going on under the hood. The general public cannot, but we can check what's going on. So, for example, think about all the problems with self-driving cars. Sometimes that's just because of bad training data.
Mm-hmm.
And if all the code is hidden, no one knows.
Yeah.
What kind of problems are you referring to? In the self-driving cars, they make accidents, or are we talking about the fact that they are biased and might cause more accidents hitting people of color versus?
That's actually a good example. So I think a year or 2 years ago there was this accident where a woman of color not crossing a regular zebra path.
Crossover.
I was hit by a self-driving car, and that was because, I don't know the use case in detail, but I think that was caused by the fact that in the set of pictures used to train the self-driving car, there was no woman of color not crossing the street on a regular crossover. And that's why I don't know in detail, but that's why the car did not recognize this situation.
Yes, yeah.
And was partly causing this this accident.
So one thing that's interesting there, and because I completely agree with you that we need to be as open as possible, especially with things that, you know, where lives are at stake or decisions about people are being made. But I would say we should go even further. It's not just about opening up the code, because the code would not enable us necessarily to see these biases, right? Let's say you have the whole training pipeline of a model or something like that.
Yeah, but you also need the training data set itself.
You need the training data set in order to see whether it's biased or not.
Yeah.
So what...
But would we do that at Anchorman? Like opening... I think like the problem I sometimes feel is like, you say like, hey, can I expect the Git a pool on GitHub? Yeah, I would like to do that. But I'm always in the context like I have to... convince someone that it's commercially interesting before I can spend time on that even. And also like decisions like opening up your code, it's also a mindset. Like you have the mindset of like...
And you have to go all the way.
Yeah.
It's not about opening just part of the code.
No.
I mean, it's everything or nothing. It's,
mindset is, well, it might cost us revenue, right? But on the other hand, you might win some because, you know, people might start contributing and the code might get better, and I don't know. So that's...
Yeah, well, in the end, for a company, it's, of course, the business case that's behind it, right? I don't think that companies... I think it's a different ballgame, right? With companies, they're in competition with each other. And for instance, we do time series forecasting for different companies. And if we were to share that among companies, then no company would have an edge over another company. So the whole idea of being able to forecast as correctly as possible what's going to happen in the future is because it gives you a competitive edge. So there is a difficult, I see a difficulty there for companies to open up because they have a different incentive there. But this is about solving a solution for a company, and it's only the company's problem. But there are also software developers that create software that is more general purpose, that there it should serve the general public or it should help a lot of companies. And I think companies like Microsoft, they make some things open source.
Yeah, more and more.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the question is, like, is the competition always, is the competition a good mindset? Like, you can also have in science, like, a competitive mindset. Like, well, if I open up my stuff, like, someone else might get away with it or something. So maybe competition isn't...
Yeah, well, and it has to do with the fact that we are operating in a field which is fast moving. So new developments are published every single minute. So if you're working on some prediction model, that's maybe already settled out. And it's just a matter of fine-tuning it for a specific company or specific data set.
Right.
But we're in a field, and especially in AI and active learning and neural networks, I mean, the field is fast moving. Mm-hmm. So how can you keep up with new developments? And you want actually everyone to benefit from new developments. And the only way forward is doing it together.
Yeah, I think I see that that specific point. You also see this coming out of all the research lab, right? The Googles and the Microsofts and the Amazons. And they publish a lot of the stuff they do.
Mm-hmm.
They make a lot of things available. Mm-hmm. Right. So for instance, we talked about the BERT embedding, right? The word embedding. That is something that you can download freely from the internet, from GitHub, and then use it and fine tune it for your own purpose. So I think these big tech companies have definitely embraced this in some part, but I think also they keep stuff for themselves.
Yeah.
Right. They're not opening up everything, and that's because
they're not an open source company.
No, that's the point. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the big difference with academia. I think academia, like, by nature, by its sheer DNA, should be an open endeavor, right? I think that most...
Yeah, should is the correct word.
Should, ought to be. And with that fits opening up your code. Yeah, okay, so what's the... Okay, so you've embraced open source. You've embraced open science. What's the state there? Is this something that we can expect the entirety of academia to do and to follow your lead there? Or
I think we're moving slowly into that direction. Thing is, it's not so easy to do this. I mean, to be honest, I have a permanent position. I don't really care about publishing another article. But if you're a young, early career scientist without a permanent position, you still have to get a grant to get your next contract. Will you then make the decision to publish another paper, which everyone will recognize and award?
Mm-hmm.
Or will you then choose to publish your code openly? And then I'm not talking about just putting a script on GitHub or whatever repository. I'm talking about making code reproducible and usable. And that's a complete... That might cost you 2 or 3 papers per year. Or even more.
Mm-hmm.
Will you dare to make that decision? And I can see that many young people really want to and try to and do their best. But then also it's challenging. I mean, how will you take the next step in your career?
Yeah,
I see that point.
I mean, for me, back when I was still in academia, I had the same... I had the same issues. So when we I wrote a package, not a package, doesn't really matter what it's doing, but it's being used a lot. But yes, it's not rewarded. But I still think there's a fundamental difference.
Yeah, but the thing is, Ron, yes, it is rewarded, but via a different route.
Okay, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, people are using it. You're saying it yourself. It's still on Serum. People are using it.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's useful
your
to people, and that's the reward, yeah.
Yeah.
And not all the issue requests and the feature requests that you're getting throughout the day.
Which you can ignore
at the company.
Like.
You don't have time anymore to work on it. Yeah.
No. But it's really open source project. So that's the next level again. Yeah. So you publish your scripts on Serum. People can download it in R. But then the next step is to develop it even further, to maintain it, and then an open source community is needed.
Mm-hmm.
You should not be maintaining it and developing new features.
You are right.
The community should do that.
Yeah.
Like I'm now receiving a pull request from Raul, hopefully, with this surprise paper. I'm joking about it, but that's how it works. So if the community really thinks that a specific feature of my tool or your R package is needed, then someone will do a pull request.
Mm-hmm. So that's the idea. Yeah. So just out of curiosity, what are now the next steps that you want to take with AS Review, and what are the kind of this can be like a shout out to like guys you're listening, if you can contribute, these are the things we need right now.
Yeah. So we're working towards the release of version 1. So I think we're now at version 0.17 or something. So we already have many pre-releases.
All Python, right?
Sorry.
All Python code.
No. So the backend is Python. Then we have React to communicate with the front. So there are different levels of.
Yeah.
So the software is rather complicated because you have this nice front end where people are reading the abstract, but on the same time in the backend the machine learning model is being trained. So there's a lot of communication back going on between the front end and the backend because this is an asynchronous process.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to wait till the machine learning model is done. You can keep on screening abstracts. So that's why it's complicated. So we're working towards the release of 1.0. And there are a couple of features that are really needed for people actually using it. For example, one is people really want to make notes. So you're reading an abstract which does not fit your research goal, but it is a very relevant paper to you or maybe to your wife or your friend. What to do with that paper? And then in a normal classical review, people would mark it as relevant because then it goes on to the next stage where you download the full text and then you download the full text of this specific paper and it's not put in the research folder, but it's put in the folder, to be read on Sunday morning. But if you do this with AS Review, with active learning, you're actually training the model on this. So you're actually training the model on the papers that you think are relevant for your friends or for reading on Sunday morning.
And then you mess the model is mixed up. Then you mess up your digital assistant. Like you're confusing him, like because it's too complex what you want.
Yeah, so that's one of the features we're still working on. That's actually very complicated because there's this asynchronous process going on. So you're making this comment. This comment has to be pushed to the backend. It has to become part of the model. No, and then it becomes a little bit complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're dealing a lot with these kind of issues in Anchorman as well. We have lots of projects where we have the front end, back end, and then the data science pipeline behind it.
Yeah.
And we're using many of the same technologies that I hear you say right now. So it's the So I think that's very interesting to see that academia is now actually then also starting to use these technologies that have been created in the context of lots of different interests of companies. And I think also what's interesting is that these are all open source technologies that you're mentioning, right?
Yeah, for sure. But the interesting thing here is this has nothing to do with science because I cannot publish a paper on this commentary option built into the software. So we always have to make a decision between features that are useful for our end users, but then that's actually software. But I'm a scientist, so I actually put more effort into improving the software from a scientific perspective. So adding more simulation options, adding a better feature extraction technique, that's more of my interest, because I want to publish a paper on the performance or on new features that are implemented from the scientific perspective.
But what you're saying is what you actually want is you want to make your assistant to be more intelligent, so he understands like there are different objectives I have. So one objective is my review, but I also have another project I'm working on, and I don't want to miss. So maybe you want to have different personalities of different topics, and if you have a real life assistant or if you're doing it yourself, you can do that easily. So you would want to increase the complexity or the intelligence, so that that might still be a scientific question, right? So.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, true. Yeah. And so, but you have to realize AS Review is actually like a universe with you know, the core and all kinds of plugins and systems associated with it. But the brilliant part of it is actually the simulation mode. So because we have all these different feature extraction techniques, we have all the different classifiers built into it, like Naive Bayes, but many more, including neural networks and deep learning models. And you can actually add your own deep learning models if you want to add a new one. And that's the brilliant part of AS Review. It's a research project. Oh yeah, and by the way, the front end can also be used for end users that are actually doing a systematic review. But the cool part is actually the simulation mode where you can compare performances of different machine learning models.
And so what's the roadmap now? What's going to be the next steps? Next time we hear about AS review in the news, what's going to be the next big thing?
Yeah, the next big thing is so we've already developed a Docker so that you can run AS review on a server, and I think that's going to be the next major thing, to run AS review in the cloud. So currently you have to install Python on your PC and start up AS review locally, which is a good thing because then the data remains yours. It's really safe, and that's why a lot of parties are actually using AS review, because it is not a server hosted solution. But of course, we also need a server-hosted solution for the people who don't care about privacy and data ownership.
Well, here I have to step in a little bit. Having something in the cloud does not necessarily mean it's not safe or not secure or not private. Actually, we deal with a lot of clients for which this is very important, and we make sure that that is all compliant. Having said that, very nice next step, I would say. Docker is a great technology, and you can run it locally still, and you can run it in the cloud.
Yeah, and it's already, I think our Docker is already installed, I think 100,000 times or something. Yeah. So people are making use of it. Hmm.
It's by the way, it's something that maybe Anchorman can help with as well. If we ever have a one-day tech marathon, which sometimes we have here, we can maybe contribute with the company. Maybe it's a good time to transition a little bit more to some of the philosophical things that were shining through a little bit earlier already. So I know that you were talking about, Raoul has almost consistently been saying assistant when we were talking about models. He's already talking about it as if it's a real person that you're collaborating with.
Anthropomorphizing it.
Yeah. And so how do you see this, Rens? Where is this going, this whole development of AI assisting humans or replacing humans? Where are we going? Where are we headed?
Yeah, so personally, I dislike the interpretation of AI or machines replacing humans. Mm-hmm. Of course, that happens in industry and in many, many different places, but I very much like the idea of interacting with machinery so that the AI and the human become both more intelligent. And that's, I referred to the Oracle previously. So in our system, the human still makes a decision. So there's no machine making a decision for you. The only thing the machine does is rank order the papers based on relevance scores. And then you as a human, you're the Oracle. So it's not that a machine is making the decision like this paper is relevant to you. No, it's like suggesting it and as an assistant. So I think it was a perfect metaphor. So it's like your electronic learning assistant who is presenting you a paper like, is this relevant to you maybe?
Yeah.
And then you're your Oracle.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big difference with many AI solutions where the decision is made for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that a lot of times when people are considered about bias, for example. And then you have the classic example of Amazon trains hiring people, and then the algorithm is biased towards white males in their 40s or something like that. But then I would say, like, it might be interesting not to replace the hiring, but to increase the intelligence of the people they're hiring, because it's not a solution to say, oh, the algorithm is biased, let's continue what we're doing, because Now it's biased. So you could use the algorithm to increase your self-awareness, for example, to learn like, oh, I'm not trying to replace my decisions, but I just want to be confronted. But obviously, I am biased in my hiring procedure.
And you can actually train the model in such a way that this bias can be reduced.
Yeah.
So instead of just naively using the list produced by software who you should hire, you should actually feed the information back into the software, like, okay, oh, this person, that was not a good idea.
But not even to replace your decision, but just to have someone that's giving you feedback, like, hey, you're just keep on doing what you're doing, you're hiring people, but I'm your assistant, and I'm just trying to make you more honest.
Yeah.
Or what's, more
what's
better
actually
at what
interesting
you're doing.
Is because it looks like these are two different things, but they're actually pretty similar, but they have different outcomes. So what you're trying to do with AS review is you're trying to internalize what basically the mind of the researcher would want and have a machine do that for the researcher, help make the selection. And so if the researcher says, I'm interested in selecting these kind of papers, then the algorithm learns that and it will select these kind of papers. So explicitly needs to do what is in the mind of the researcher. Now, in the Amazon hiring thing, if you have a model that is doing exactly what the humans want the model to do, it becomes biased because it internalizes all the biases
because
that
the
are
humans
already
are
in the
biased.
Minds of the people.
Yeah.
And so there's, on the one hand, it's very similar. On the other hand, it produces opposite outcomes in terms of what we want, right?
Yeah. But I think that the difference is in the objective. Like, if your objective is we want to replace the hiring process, we want to completely automate it, then you have a problem. But if your objective is we want the machine to cooperate, then you can say, I don't want it to replace, I just want to know, to increase my self-awareness of how I am biased, and the machine can help me with that. So that's a different...
Yeah. To give a good example, we often get feature requests whether we can show the author names of an article. And we don't show the author names because to avoid bias, you just have to read the text of the abstract and make your decision. Whether Raoul wrote the paper or Ron wrote the paper does not really matter. It's about the content. But many people ask us to provide author names. And then you end up in exactly the same paradox as with Amazon, because then you're making decisions because of authorship names, and then it becomes really complicated.
Wait a second. Is your algorithm, your machine learning model, taking as inputs potentially also author names?
No, we deliberately not do so.
So you have before feature engineering, you have a phase where you scratch out all the known author names from a paper before it feeds into the model?
No, we just simply do not use a column containing authorship names.
Right, but there are authors in the text, right? In the
body
text.
But not in the abstract.
Almost never.
That's true.
Okay, so that's also, I thought maybe it was screening the entire paper. It's just using based on abstracts, which should reflect the gist of the paper. So
yes. Although often the abstract is written just a day before submitting a paper. So
yeah.
But it's actually the most read part of your paper, and most abstracts are not even seen by any human, but they are seen by machines. So actually, everyone's abstract is read by at least one machine learning model, by I don't know, Google or Amazon or.
I wonder what it means if at some point you gather statistics about what papers end up being included a lot and papers that are never being included. Is there like, can you find hidden gems that nobody ever reads but people should read?
Yeah, that must be possible.
Collect all the data from all the users from the, which of course would be a problem with privacy, but.
Yeah, I remember there was a project where YouTube movies were selected, which were only seen by one person. But as soon as someone clicked on that list, of course, then the YouTube movie itself disappeared from the list again, because then it was seen by two persons and then it was not listed anymore. So that would be a fun project, Ron.
Yeah, it would. Well,
but I think most of the papers published in academia are never cited, at least.
Yeah.
But they are read by machines.
Yeah, so the machines are the best scientific literature readers, and that's why it makes sense you built this. So what's the... more general, what's the future? Is not just for AI's review, but in terms of AI and people, right? You're saying we're not going to be replaced, but AI can do some stuff better than we. What's your feeling? Where are we headed towards?
Yeah, I think what is really needed. So we're heading towards a society where interacting with AI becomes the norm. We're already doing it, but we don't realize it. So I think we should train people that interacting with AIs means something different than interacting with humans.
Mm.
And I think people should realize that you have an impact on how the AI performs, because it's an interaction. I mean, the machine is learning from you, from your behavior. And I think we should make people more aware of the fact that you're often actually changing the AI on your cell phone.
Mm-hmm. And so what would that help? Because either if I know that, if I'm aware of that, is it a bad thing that we have this interaction with the AI and that the AI is changed by our behavior? Is it a good thing? What's the...
No, I think it's a good thing, as long as you can avoid bias. Because bias, that's always in any machine learning AI type of approach, that's always the big problem, I think.
Yeah.
like garbage in, garbage out.
But I mean, don't you always have bias? Like even sampling from uniform distribution, that's not everything that's there. So, you know, even if you ask an algorithm to drop you at a random event, so the guy I was talking about told about he was in India and then he visited a yoga class and then he said, well, this is the third yoga class this week I was randomly assigned to. Yeah, of course you're in India, yeah. Right? So
and from a purely random perspective, he could have had yoga classes for the next 5 years nonstop. That's also a random process. So
if that would never happen, it would not be random.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. So you always have a bias, at least even like the environment, even that we're in the Netherlands.
So maybe we should accept that AI is always biased.
Yeah, I think so.
And because humans are biased. AI is biased, a human is biased. And maybe we have to accept a certain level of biasness of machine learning.
Yeah. I agree with that because I think that basically if you need to make a decision based on input data, you need to find a function that maps input data to a decision. And that function means that there has to be some bias. The question is whether it's fair or not, I would say.
Yeah.
So we have a whole episode about fairness and algorithms actually in this podcast series. So please, you know, if you're listening and want to know more about this, go back to one of the previous episodes. I think actually that we are automating more and more and more. Right, it started with industrialization, then IT came there, and everything became digital. We're automating some stuff with if-then rules, and now the automation becomes more intelligent. Right, we can automate more and more and more. And what happens? I don't know. I think it's not that black and white. We are going to be replaced. We're not going to replace. I think what you're showing right now is that you've built something and it's not even using the most complex algorithms, because you're saying already quite some of the simpler algorithms are able to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
You're building something that can do an intellectual job that previously was done by scientists alone.
Yep.
So I am not sure about us not being replaced.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, replacing is a sad term, because so let's say you can save 80% of your time screening abstracts. You can do two, actually you can do three things. As from a company perspective, you can say, okay, I can save 50 to 80% of my revenue, so I'm going to fire people because we need fewer people to do the same task. But that's typically not what we see happening. So either people take the next step in their research. So doing a systematic review takes less time. So you can start quicker doing your experiments or whatever you're doing next. That's what we see most, is that people don't take the time benefit, but what they do is they search in a broader search database. So they start out with not 10,000 papers, but they do the same research question. So they try to answer the same research question, not with 10,000 papers, but with 100,000 papers.
Yeah. So it improves the quality.
So it improves the quality.
Yeah.
So they're including preprints. They're maybe including journals that they excluded because they had to make a decision to narrow down the search. So they're now maybe including, I don't know, journals that are more obscure, or maybe open access journals that were not harvested by, I don't know, PubMed or something.
Right.
So they're actually not taking the time benefit, but they're increasing the quality.
So I'm thinking about what does science and the scientists look like 20 years from now. So I have AS Review. By then, like 20 years from now, I will probably tell it I'm interested in COVID-19. It will make already like a really good selection for me.
Yeah, and it will summarize the data, write your paper.
It already knows all my previous papers, so it already knows a little bit what I'm interested in. And I say, okay, let's write a paper from this. Do I even still need to write a paper myself, or I'm going to use like language models that are generating the text for me based on the... So then I have my paper. Let's review it. Oh, AS Review has a simulation mode where it can simulate the reviewer feedback based on reading all the reviewers from all the papers. Then publish it. Well, who needs to read it? Why do people even need to read it still?
Yeah, you just have to put it in a pool of papers. I mean, then Google
then
will have a huge database with pre-trained models, and you simply add your paper to it.
Right.
And it doesn't even look like a paper because it's already vectorized.
Who needs words? Words are so inefficient.
I don't think that a research paper in 20 years from now consists of words we will recognize as humans, because the paper is probably going to be read by machines instead of humans.
And why would it even need to summarize? It can just be the data of the paper, right? If it's an empirical paper, just put the data there. The machines understand it.
Yeah.
What is science going to be like 20 years? And is there even a human going to be in the loop there?
I think what you're showing or you're pointing out things that can be replaced by machine. But I think what's interesting about what Rens is saying is like it gives us space to develop things that we think are human. So that's some sort of paradox, right? So I think we see the same in healthcare, right? So the paradox in healthcare with AI is it can make healthcare more human, because if you do the boring and stuff and the routine stuff, you can let a machine do that, then you as a human you have more time for empathy and for actual care and creativity
and interpretation.
So I think even though what you're showing is might be right, like okay, the papers might be completely vectorized and stuff like that, and we might feed it in through a neural link our example, but my ideal is that it will make us more human and more creative, something like, or it could give space to that.
So AI that is also creative, that's maybe not on the market in the next 20 years.
I'm not sure. I mean, there are algorithms. I can say, give me an avocado chair, and it generates images of an avocado chair, though it has never seen before an avocado chair, and it looks photorealistic.
That's about images. We're now talking about the interpretation of, I don't know, sociology or psychological events or...
So you have this model, language model called GPT-3, and it generates text as if written by a person. It doesn't make sense, although if, you know, it makes more... It feels when you read it like there's somebody with thought behind it, even though it's not there. It's just taking statistical summaries from text it can find on Wikipedia and Twitter, and then generates text relevant to a topic for it.
But Ron, are you now then saying that my job does not exist in 20 years? Does anyone have tissues here? Cry.
I'm just pushing.
Why did you invite me actually, Ron, for this podcast?
I'm pushing it to the extreme because I wanna understand where we're heading. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm hearing human qualities are what's going to keep us there. I'm hoping our AI overlords will agree that they care about empathy.
Well, I think you should have ideals, right? So, and your ideals can, like, even so, open science, and it's an ideal, and then you can say like, okay, can we work towards that, or can we open source also the commercial stuff, and like, okay, and that gives tension, but. Yeah. I think it's good to have ideals, right?
I agree. And I also think, I mean, let me be clear. My job will be gone before your job is gone. I mean,
But what we will then do?
Well, that's the question. I mean, if nobody needs to, if all the intellectual stuff can be done by the AI, if all the physical stuff can be done by robots, then we can, you know, just enjoy life.
Enjoy life.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now we're working our ass off, and then in 20 years we can finally enjoy.
I really enjoy doing stuff like this, like inventing stuff and creating new stuff. So I would be really sad if I wouldn't be able to work. I just really enjoy, you know, having problems and thinking about it.
But you cost more money than an AI to a company.
Yeah, okay, but maybe we should... So shift to a universal basic income anyway, right? So no one has to care about working for your money, and you can do just what you.
I just want to have on the record that I think the AS review is the first step into making all the scientists without jobs.
So I remembered. I think 2 years ago I was in a meeting where we were talking about. The new way of writing grant proposals at the Dutch Research NVO Institute. And there was a paragraph about that every single application should contain a systematic review.
Hmm.
After a long discussion, that paragraph was deleted and it's not needed now. But with tools like AS Review, you can do a systematic review within one or 2 weeks. So why not doing a systematic review for any single grant application? Yeah. Why not... starting out every single paper with the current state of affairs. I mean, we now write an introduction section with just papers we know of, but why not doing it systematically?
I think it's a huge improvement over the way of working right now. I totally agree. And with that, I think maybe we can wrap it up. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rens, for joining. I thought this was a very interesting discussion. Raoul, thank you for co-hosting.
Yeah. Thanks.
See you some other time.
Did we inspire you? Tune in for the next episodes. Or visit our website, anchorman.nl. There you'll find more on bootcamps, AI masterclasses, or careers. See you at the next episode.